welcome. Another edition of Expanding Minds. We'll continue our exploration of the cultures of consciousness. One of the weirdest things about the 19th century, in my book, is the phenomenon of spiritualism, the explosion of seances, mediums, spirit talking, ectoplasm, Ouija boards, et cetera, that took off in an extraordinarily popular way starting in the middle of the century. And it's one of those phenomena that it's a stands between the past and us. You know, if you imagine a world before the rise of science and modern rationalism, and you imagine a world filled with ghosts and spirits and goddesses and priestesses and all of the sort of rich pre-modern world of the spiritual imagination, and then you think about our world today, which I'll leave uncharacterized for the moment. And spiritualism stands in this really interesting place just in between those two worlds, and I'm really happy that we're going to be speaking with Professor Jill Galvin today about spiritualism, and particularly about the links it makes between gender and technology. I was particularly interested in Professor Galvin's book, The Sympathetic Medium, because I wrote about some of these connections in my book, Technosis, a long, long time ago, particularly the link between the occult, if you want to think about it that way, and communications technology and the interesting ways in which it reverberates and resonates today as we plunge forward on our intensely technological society that still manages to have the some of the old ghosts out. But before we bring on Dr. Galvin, of course, we'll introduce our co-host here on Expanding Mind, Maja Daou. Hi, Maja.
Hi.
Hey, have you ever been to a seance, to like a real seance?
I totally have been to a seance. In fact, I've had some pretty good, crazy spiritualist experiences with dead people. So, but then I've also been to super cheesy ones where the mediums were totally faking it. And I have had the at the Magic Castle, you know, of course, they have the Houdini room where all this, like, they do like a performance of the fake seance and stuff like that, and they kind of ham it up since Houdini tried to bust. Like, when spiritualism was happening, there was this backlash, and Houdini was kind of at the forefront and, of course, formed the Society for Psychical Research, trying to bust mediums and seances that were total phonies. So I've kind of seen it from both ends of the spectrum, where I've seen the phonies and then also had crazy contact with ghosts. So,
but did you go to like for the more real deal ones, were they organized? Like, were people sitting around a table? Was there a medium, or was it more just sort of experiences that you had?
The one that was, to me, seemed like the realest deal wasn't planned, and it kind of arose out of nowhere where someone offered to do it all of a sudden, but it wasn't like the purpose of it was to go have a seance. It was more like a bunch of people were there, and then someone was like, hey, let's see if we can do this, and then it happened. So, and the ones
like,
that were planned, those were the phony ones.
Yeah, it sounds like the 14-year-old Ouija board style. I hope 14-year-olds still screw around with Ouija boards these days.
I'm sure they do.
That's good. All right, well, we'll bring Professor Galvin onto the show. Thanks so much for joining us here on Expanding Mind.
Oh, thank you. It's great to be here.
Excellent. Well, you know, I kind of want to start out, you know, talking a little bit about the popularity of spiritualism, particularly in the academy. It seems like over the last 10, 15 years, there's just been an explosion of writing and books, mostly from historians, but people really diving into that stuff. And I know you're a professor of English, but I'm just kind of curious how you found your way into this sort of intense interest in spiritualism, how it grew out of your own your previous interests.
Right. Well, my this was my first book. The Sympathetic Medium is my first book, and like many first books, and pretty much all of them, it grew out of my dissertation. And I was working in English. My field is particularly the 19th century British Victorian Lit. And it, like many people's dissertation experiences, I started with one kind of project, and it was huge and undoable. And it had to do with this idea of the permeable subject that I was thinking about happening kind of in the later 19th century into the 20th century, where internal states become readable on the exterior, and then the exterior world kind of permeates the inside. And so I was thinking about that, and one expression of that that I was thinking about was the occult. And because I had kind of knew very vaguely about seances and about the interest in mesmerism, and then later in the century, telepathy. And then another expression of it was, of this idea of the permeable subject, was new technologies and the way they make possible the transmission of interiority, kind of interior thoughts, long distance in a way that seems to suggest that you can basically extract a part of yourself and send it somewhere else. And so I looked at these two things together, and I kind of got pushed in the direction of thinking about those two things in particular, narrowing the project down to that. And then from that place, I decided then to narrow it further to look at the woman medium in both these realms, in the spiritualist realm as the favored gender for communicating spirit transmissions, and also as the favored gender in things like telephone operating and typing. And so that became kind of my question, was why is this position of communications mediation feminized?
Yeah, so it's one of the wonderful things about the book. I really like books that triangulate or move between different zones in a rich way. So I know on the one hand, you're talking about this occult religion, very popular, very influential occult religion. On the other hand, you're talking about the rise of communications technology and the new forms of labor that women are doing in particular, secretaries, stenographers, telephone operators, ultimately. But where it was really interesting for me that I didn't really expect, because I kind of knew about your thesis before I looked at your book, is that you, rather than looking at the history of spiritualism that in that much detail in terms of like the actual groups who are doing seances, you really spend most of your time looking at literature. I mean, obviously,
right.
You're an English major, but there's something, so there's these, it's a wonderful mix of familiar greats, Henry James and Conan Doyle and
yeah.
Dracula, with some really weird books that,
mm-hmm.
I think very few people have heard of. What is it about looking at literature rather than, let's say, the records of seances or the Society for Psychical Research? What is it that literature kind of lets us see into what's going on in the culture and the minds of people at this time?
Right. Well, I think that, I mean, this is a really good question about our field in general, about English in general, but the kind of short answer would be that we're always, as cultures, telling stories about ourselves, and the figures that we give credence to, like as vocations, say, like the female typist, it's because we've developed a certain kind of cultural image, or we've told a certain kind of narrative to ourselves about what women do and why women are most appropriate for that. So that in some ways looking at the literature becomes a way of looking at the way people kind of figured out what narratives they want to tell themselves about, okay, we've got this new technology, who's going to operate it? Why should they operate it? What do women do? Why are women most appropriate? So that would be, and especially I think when you have, as you do in the 19th century, just this wealth of new technologies that people are trying to get their heads around and yet quickly become endemic to the culture, it becomes especially important to figure out what those roles, those images, those tropes are going to be. And so I think you see in the narratives a kind of trying to sort that out and maybe some conflicts. People are telling some stories and working them against other stories and other versions of how these technologies should be. But that was my interest in kind of exploring that ground and those conflicts.
In a way, I kind of wanted you to give us a flavor of one of these more obscure books and what they told you, you know, one of the more popular novels, and what they helped you see about this question of, like, what is it in the ideas of what women are and what their powers are that enable them to really gain such extraordinary power, both in this movement and, you know, albeit in a sort of, you know, constrained way because of the hierarchy of labor, nonetheless, that they become associated as the sort of dominant gender for certain technological tasks as well.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that I found both in the fictions that I was looking at and the non-fictional discourse, like the essays and the periodical literature and that kind of thing, was an emphasis on a couple of features of these women that were mediating these communications as spirit mediums and operators and typists and all that, that I thought was interesting, that and no matter what the specific vocation, we kept coming back to this. And one of them was sympathy, the idea that that the typist was particularly sympathetic, could kind of identify and intuit what her employer wanted, or the telephone operator was sympathetic with her client, or, and especially with spirit mediums, that that she was defined by her sympathy or sensitivity at a nervous level. She was very delicate and nervous. And so, and I came to see that sympathy is tied to, it grows kind of out of a 19th century idea of femininity generally, which says that women are, have a greater capacity to feel, kind of as the nurturers of the culture, as the domestic icons of the culture, and because they're more self-effacing and altruistic, so they're more concerned with others' feelings than their own. And so I was interested in the way that got worked into these positions that were about communication and creating connections between people, and the way being able to feel for the other and to kind of reach out to the other becomes a way of enabling communication.
It's really interesting, too, because, of course, the word sympathy and the idea of sympathy plays an extraordinarily important role in occult philosophy as well, and particularly in the early modern period, where you clearly, as people keep sort of reconfiguring these occult views of the world and how the world works, you know, coming out of alchemy, coming out of the Hermetic tradition, and yet they're encountering more and more science, including magnetism and optics, and so people start talking about sympathy as a way of describing, you know, if you take the alchemical maxim, as above, so below, well, how does the above and the below connect? They connect through sympathy.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that really was something that was like a big part of the Golden Bough, right? I mean, that James Frazier, who was kind of a jerk, but he breaks it down to, like, all magic basically operates by sympathy. If you want to attract a thing, you pretend you're the thing. You want to make rain, you pretend you're rain. Like, in order to get in touch and communicate with something, you pretend you're the thing. So it's kind of like that's what the trick of all magic is. You have to go into sympathy with the thing.
Right, right. Yeah, and I think it's interesting because in the 19th century, you kind of have, like, this perfect storm of components. So you do have that history of sympathy as crucial to these ideas of magic. At the same time that you really have, like, a hardening of the idea of the domestic woman, the woman as domestic icon, as nurturer. And this is all kind of part of the modernity, I think, that is particularly happening, kind of like speeding up in the 19th century. So I see exactly what you're saying, and I think that the way that the gender roles get kind of calcified at that moment feeds into what then seems to be needed in these occult scenarios.
Well, is it so interesting, too, because you start to be able, I think this is particularly true of the 19th century, and it really, I think, helps then look at more modern phenomena where it's often much more confusing. But in the 19th century, you can see the way that the same concept, the same word even, in the case of sympathy, plays these multiple roles. So it's at once connects with this sort of occult tradition that's trying to remake itself in the face of science, which seems to be disenchanting the world. Mm-hmm. It's also this kind of affect, domestic affect that's associated with women and how women are and how they're what their nature is. But it's also, what, as you mentioned, almost a kind of technical mm-hmm. quality that may be the nervous system, mm-hmm. but it's also kind of the system, the way that messages pass, the way that transmissions occur. So there's a weird, like, technical aspect to it, too, that you really picked up in a way that I think a lot of other people who've written about spiritualism, at least that I've read, haven't really done. So let's talk a little bit about that new technical world of transmissions and networks and how that plays into this changing or calcifying even image of women.
Well, specifically in the spiritualist context, in the context of the seance, it's really interesting because the spiritualists were very invested in thinking about spiritualism as a science, as a figuring out of natural laws. And that this is the way they defended themselves, and partially they were reacting to a culture where empiricism was more and more, science was more and more kind of gaining the day as a language in which people could think about society. So they thought about what they did and the best ways of conducting a seance in terms of laws, and one of the things they tried to do was to optimize the electromagnetic conditions of seance. So in some cases you'll hear about even the seance is thought of as a kind of battery, where you, for instance, try to organize sitters, in other words, the people at the seance, and the medium in such a way as to optimize the magnetic currents. And the idea was that then you're creating a kind of communication line with the other world, the spirits already being adept at using this form of communication. And this is, I mean, and it's quite explicit in the language around spiritualism. Mediums are called machines. They're thought of in terms of automatism when they go unconscious, in terms of going automatic. They're sometimes called wires for the spirits. And they're often, spiritualism often uses the telephone and the telegraph and the camera as analogies for talking about and legitimizing what they do, and for helping kind of the reader in these treatises, for example, to understand what they do. So the technology this is what I find so interesting is, I mean, I think you think on the face of it that this is something that scholars today are back reading onto the spiritualism, that we are comparing it all to technologies, but it's something that actually arises out of the moment.
Well, yeah, and if you look at the history of the telephone and how it originated, it was, in fact, a big part of it was to talk to spirits. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's that spirit phone is on display at the Thomas Edison Museum. And so mm-hmm. it's not like it's what you're saying is absolutely true. The whole purpose for the technology, some of them had that, you know, mm-hmm. inherent in them when they were being built.
Mm-hmm. Was it Watson, I guess, Bell's assistant?
Yeah,
he was very interested in, right, in using the telephone in that way, yeah.
And then the thing that's often mentioned in the history is that the first, you know, message sent on the telegraph is really within a year of the Fox sisters and their mm-hmm. rather
totally.
Telegraphic way in communicating with spirits using raps, using a sort of simple code. So there's something about, and what I love about these connections, especially this one, it's just so rich, is that, you know, you might have the tendency to kind of want to prioritize one or the other. It's like, well, what's actually happening is that technology is changing society and culture, and that this is a response to it. You know, mm-hmm. that spiritualism is a kind of attempt to respond to it, or that there are these, you know, inherent religious patterns and quests and questions and experiences that just keep flowing through history, and they're just going to grab whatever is going on in terms of the contemporary culture, the way that people, you know, talk about quantum physics now and computers and, you know, holography as a sort of model of the spiritual world. But in a way, it's kind of both and more than either one. And that's where you really get some, I mean, it's some of the stuff you talk about, some of these images, it's almost like we're you know, people are working with things on multiple levels at once. So I'm kind of curious how you see, like what happened? What was that moment in the middle of the 19th century? Was it just a sort of development of technology, or is kind of something, a different kind of transmission, if you will, is occurring in human culture?
Do you mean what happened as far as why spiritualism arose, or why these things were put in terms of technology and vice versa?
No, just why spiritualism arose in this technological context.
Well, I think, one of the ways that generally to think about why spiritualism arose, or at least took hold in the crazy way it did, because, and I say crazy in the sense that it was a craze. I mean, it was just so popular, was that this was also the time that where you have evolutionary theory and other kind of scientific discourses and disciplines like paleontology and geology kind of under or eroding an idea of Christianity and kind of challenging the Bible as a source of belief and as a source of kind of inherited ideas of the spirit, so that sometimes people think about spiritualism as an attempt to reclaim the spirit. But the other way to think about it in those terms is that, again, spiritualism is really invested in saying, okay, this is the culture we live in, a culture where someone like Darwin is bringing science and empiricism to the fore and making it the basis of our knowledge, so that we have to develop our own language and ideas in terms of science and empiricism and natural laws. And I think that technology, looking at the technology is another way to do that. It's another way to say, look, this is already empirically proven as possible as a means of communication. And so this is another kind of thing that the spiritualists can latch onto.
I mean, it's also interesting there to bring in the point about women, too. I mean, at this time, you have this, like, huge scientific industrial kind of push with, you know, it's mainly male-driven, I mean, for the most part, and even with, like, the Darwin stuff and everything. And then, happening on the other end of the spectrum, I mean, you have, like, Marie Curie, you know, who she had that, I think it was, like, 1911 or something, and she's basically, like, a woman scientist, which is crazy. I mean, even today, I think the statistics are like 5% of physicists are women or something completely stupid like that. And she was the first person to get 2 Nobel Prizes, like in history at that time. And it was a woman. And it was like part of bringing the female version of science and that women actually could be scientists too. And then you have like the spiritualist movement happening at the same time, kind of combating like some of the Darwinian business. And to me, I think you could see it happening at that level as well.
Yeah. And I mean, when Eric mentioned before that spiritualism and the occult have been just such a hot topic for the past 2 or maybe even 3 decades in scholarship. And I think one of the reasons is the focus on women and the way that they were the core of spiritualism because they were favored as mediums. And so it's a place to kind of look at where women did have a pivotal place in culture. And what I think people have found so fascinating is that it is a pivotal place, but it's a deeply contradictory pivotal place because it was all about the reason that women were selected as the best mediums was because they were considered inherently feeling, passive, self-effacing.
Well, and it's also even weirder, too, like on a shamanic level. Like if you're going to get into biology style, women carry mitochondrial DNA, which it's the female mitochondrial DNA, which actually traces us back to our ancestors. Like there was all that business with Lucy and how there is no male mitochondrial DNA. And to trace us back, the thing that hooks us up with kind of our dead past, as we as individuals can trace our lineage, is actually through our mothers. So it's pretty crazy on that level, too, if you look at it scientifically.
One of the aspects that you already talked about why women were chosen for both of these roles, both for seances and for communications work, was the idea of sympathy. But you also talk about the idea of automatism,
right,
that they were being able to sort of be rendered machine-like or utterly passive, in fact, not even present for some of the things. Where does that come from? Where does that association of women and automatism kind of come from?
Well, I think during the 19th century, you mentioned before how mobile the term sympathy is and how it can get used in so many different contexts, and it's a really slippery, nebulous term. I think at the same time, there's a science of the nerves arising at this time that can, again, be used in really mobile ways and really ways that we, looking back, can recognize as very politically and ideologically invested. But one of the ways that nerves were talked about is this was a new way to understand mental diseases and mental deficiencies and things like hysteria, whereas before we have thinking about women's hysteria in terms of the uterus or the womb, now that still holds some sway, but people were also thinking in terms of a phenomenon of the nerves and a weak nervous system. And one demonstration for people at this time of a kind of a nervous debility or a nervous weakness is this tendency to go unconscious. It's a reversion to a more kind of primitive mental state, and therefore, somewhat predictably, I guess, women were considered to be more susceptible to it because they were not as strong in terms of their nerves, which of course are related to the brain, and were thought of at that time as well then too. So they weren't as mentally, in terms of their brain, intellectually as forceful. So they had an easier tendency to go automatic.
That sort of reminds me also about when we, oftentimes people talk about spiritualism and they don't. I think a more hidden story that you also mention is how much of this really comes out of mesmerism and the experiments with early hypnotism, the discovery of the unconscious, the discovery that the unconscious often has other personalities in it, and it does really amazing, bizarre things that we often forget about now because, psychoanalysis and its model of the unconscious really cut off a whole memory that was scientific as well as cultural and spiritual of the kinds of phenomena that people were discovering when they went into these kinds of hypnotic, mesmeric environments. And spiritualism is almost kind of like a technological transformation of some of those magnetic forces that are already flowing through culture and mind.
Yeah, and if there was one thing that I wanted to do with the book that wasn't as overt, it was to do just what you're saying, which is reclaim all that ground that seems to have been overwritten by Freud and psychoanalysis, and to say, look, we had the Victorians had this whole idea of the unconscious, of the mind, of different levels of psychology that was very different from Freud's, and spiritualism played directly into that. So did late Victorian psychology, which in strange ways intersected with spiritualism through psychical research. It was. I think that there's so much interesting, rich material there.
Yeah, I mean, one of the books that really blew me away that I read this last couple of months was, and I know you refer to it right off the bat, is Adam Crabtree's book on From Mesmer to Freud, and it's so rich with what happened. It's not, these are not like conceptual elaborations primarily. They're like people attempting to come up with systems to explain the unconscious based on all of this really weird stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, and not even getting into the phenomena that seems to point to, you know, telepathy or paranormal powers, but even if you just, even leaving aside those questions, the kinds of personality changes, the information, the characteristics, the body movements, the personalities, the new languages, I mean, it's just, it's a really extraordinary story that is, it's unfortunate that it's so forgotten, because if you know that story, then so much of more contemporary New Age phenomena and channeling and shamanism, it makes much more sense. Whereas if you have this kind of Freudian, if you just follow from the Freudian break, it's like, oh, that's just all crazy stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and so anyway, I appreciate your attempt to redress that gap. But we're actually at the half an hour point, so we're going to take a break here and come back. We're talking
okay.
with Dr. Jill Galvin here on Expanding Mind, and we'll be right back after these messages.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Maja Daou, and we're here with Eric Davis, speaking with Jill Galvin about spiritualism and ladies taking notes, channeling information. And before the break, Jill, you mentioned how women were kind of more conducive to going into unconscious states and mm-hmm. being able to kind of go under that spell. And there was something that's always been interesting to me to see happen in the progression where, okay, you have spiritualism takes over, becomes this, like, crazy fad phenomenon, and then kind of counteracting that, we see the mesmerists coming over to America, and then they kind of start going nuts, too. And you can see this weird thing that happens where initially mesmerism kind of starts gaining prominence, and they were using mesmerism to even, like, provide, you know, kind of ether in surgeries and knock people unconscious
yeah.
and getting into, like, the medical field. It starts infiltrating doctors. And then what happens is there becomes this weird, like, mix between the mesmerists and the spiritualists. And what happens, basically, is that the men, there was, no, like, no, if I'm not mistaken, there were no female mesmerists. None. There's not no female mesmerists.
Yeah.
The men get up. They are like the Svengalis, the hypnotists, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they then are the ones that control the female's ability to go into trance, to go into state, where on the opposite end, you have the spiritualists, which are the females basically controlling and running the show. And then what ends up kind of, you know, taking over is the mesmerists, and they kind of regain control of the female's, like, you know, kind of ability to go into that trance state, and then they direct it, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, what do you think kind of happened there that pushed it out of, you know, the female machine, and then it kind of had this backlash that went, that drove more into science, it seemed like?
Well, I think in some ways I feel like what's happening with spiritualism and what you're describing with mesmerism, where you have the woman as always, so the typical paradigm was that it was the male who's the mesmerist and the woman who was the subject of the mesmerism. And in some ways that, rather than being a reversal of any kind of power women have gained in the seance, it's actually just another continuation of the what's in the seance, because as we were talking about before, even if women are at the center of the seance, it's only ironically because they are considered to be less kind of intellectually powerful, lacking in agency. So in some ways you can see that as a kind of similarity rather than a difference. The other thing is, and this is something I don't know a whole lot about, but I do know that spiritualists, one side, I believe, where the male medical and scientific community really did perhaps perceive a kind of threat to their authority from women was in the context of spiritualist healing,
right?
Where women would kind of lay hands and claim to be able to see into bodies and to see their diseases in order to kind of help cure them. And I believe also laying hands as a means to manage the vital fluid, the same kind of fluid that Mesmer was talking about.
Right.
So there, I think there was a kind of resistance from the medical community. I don't know how widespread that system of spiritualist healing was. Yeah.
You know, one of the things that really intrigued me about your argument, the way you put together the idea of the spiritualist medium as a kind of technology, is that it helped explain, and you offer this explanation, one of the things that I think is hardest for even sympathetic people from our era, when we're looking back at spiritualism, when we're reading the descriptions of phenomena, it's really a tricky thing, because there's some things that seem to happen that nobody has a very good explanation for, and there's some things that seem to be, you know, you can either, you know, you can invoke, whether or not you invoke the paranormal, there's something going on, but you can kind of explain it in certain ways. But there's a huge amount of spiritualism that just looks so obviously fake. You know, mm-hmm. You look at the spirit photographs, and you're like, how? I don't care that photography had only been around for a decade. I can't believe that anybody believed this.
Mm-hmm.
And but you make this very interesting point, which is that if the medium is also a communications technology, that technology isn't always going to be perfect.
Right.
It's going to have some distortion. It's going to have noise, we would talk about in terms of, you know, information theory or an information system. So that if you're sitting there at a seance and the medium's in the cabinet, and then there's a spirit that appears out of the cabinet that's supposed to be somebody else, looks a lot like the medium, rather than going, oh, this is all hooey, you'd go, well, there's a little distortion there, because,
yeah. You
know, the figure is kind of, and it really actually makes a lot of sense for me. I mean, how do you think about that issue? I mean, it's inevitable, even if you're not dealing with this question directly in your work, which in general you're not, but if you're studying this stuff, there's this question of, like, where are they faking? Where is it some kind of, you know, group psychology? Where is there a possibility of untapped aspects of the mind? How did you find yourself, after spending time with this material, kind of coming to terms with that question of fakery and
mm-hmm.
possibility?
Well, first, it's interesting that you bring up the subject of the woman as a communication technology, and therefore as that being one of the explanations for problems in the seance. In other words, one of the explanations spiritualists would offer to excuse themselves, the reason these manifestations are poor or aren't working is because the technology isn't working, and there is this kind of idea of noise, and that's actually something that I've written about really recently, and that's going to come out soon, and that I think is really important to the philosophy. And the way that I've thought about, I mean, it's interesting. The way that I think about, well, there was cheating. I mean, there
yeah.
just definitely was. There were women who would confess to cheating. There were even when they didn't confess, it was just so obvious that they were cheating. So leaving those cases aside, the question becomes, well, what about all those cases that aren't apparent, where cheating is not apparent? Is something real going on? And is that kind of the nature of your question and how I feel about that?
Yeah, in a way,
yeah.
Just even on a personal level, like when you come across these things, I mean, wasn't it William James who talked about, you know, all you need is one white crow,
right.
Only one. If you have one white crow, it's like the whole house of cards kind of comes down. And obviously there's no way to know, but I'm just kind of curious how you, you know, do you find it more productive to kind of leave it open to the possibilities of things, or do you tend to go, well, look, they're either faking it or there's some kind of, you know, psychological process and such?
Well, you know, to go back to William James and the White Crow, I in some ways I understand his analogy. In some ways, though, I don't, because if you've decided it's a white crow, there's always still the possibility that in fact it's not. And if you just knew a little bit more about the situation, it wouldn't be.
Well, the other thing is, there's white crows in everything. Okay, look at music, for crying out loud. Okay, like, you got John Coltrane, and then you got a bunch of other dudes playing the saxophone. Just because someone gets up and plays a bad saxophone song doesn't mean John Coltrane's illegitimate. Like,
yeah,
and you
yeah.
see it in science too. There'll be, for every like amazing Nobel laureate, there'll be some schmo that drank his way through UCSB and just dinks around in the lab all the time. Like,
yeah.
The problem is, it's not just a mediumship and a cult. It's everywhere. There'll be people that are faking and not. There's posers everywhere. So I don't understand why it has to delegitimize something.
Yeah, and I mean, and for me, I guess, and I mean, personally, the way that I look at the evidence is that my impulse is not, in fact, to believe it, just because there were enough suspect conditions. For instance, the fact that according to spiritualism's natural laws, the seance often had to take place in the dark.
Right.
And the medium, before she manifested some of her phenomena, at least in a certain type of seance called the materialization seance, she had to go into a cabinet and be curtained off. So that it raises the question of what's she doing in that cabinet? There are enough little pieces like that, and then too, some of the cases where I've been most impressed and most puzzled and most wondered, is there something there? If you find out a little bit more about a little more detail, you begin to put two and two together and consider how at least it could have been engineered. Now, that said, I think when we think in terms of black and white, it's either trickery or it's real. But maybe trickery can be broken down too. In other words, this could not have been, perhaps it wasn't a real case of spiritual phenomena, but does that mean necessarily that the medium intended to cheat or had some kind of malicious, self-serving intent? And I don't think so necessarily. I think that, and this is something that I think other people have written on, that it's more of a kind of, comes out of a will to believe in a culture that maybe has a really intent will to believe, more so maybe than we do now, because of things like the countercurrents of Darwin and science, and also because they're so steeped in a culture of grieving and mourning, where death is just more of a thing, and they want to think about it and grasp for some sense of the afterlife, maybe even in a more pronounced sense than we do today. So all that's to say that I even if I have my own reservations about the legitimacy of what happened, for me it doesn't invalidate anything about the. I don't think of these people as dupes, basically,
right.
And I think it's still a very complex belief system, just as any system of spirituality is, and it comes out of a lot of complex emotions and presumptions that are worth studying.
I've always been amazed by the fact that if you talk to your average person today about the idea of telepathy, this term coined by one of the fellows who founded the Society for Psychical Research, and they would think that you're just talking about the supernatural, you're talking about some outlandish possibility that's highly unlikely to be the case. But back then, the telepathy was offered as a scientific explanation for some of the phenomena of spiritualism, because of course most of the spiritualists wanted to say no, they're spirits. and so they would, they say, actually, it's easier to explain the situation that the medium has a sensitivity, some ability to tap into information in the people at the table, that rather than invoke, you don't really need to invoke these other entities, which makes total sense to me. Indeed, when you look at how sophisticated good readers, I mean, Maja and I, we often have magicians on the show who are very interested in conjuring and mentalism, and it's extraordinary the kinds of feats that people can do who will be like, no, I'm not doing anything supernatural. And the idea that those would be powers that people would even have unconsciously is totally conceivable. So you can imagine a situation where these really extraordinary capacities of the mind are being tapped and sort of set up mm-hmm. in this kind of, you know, religious sort of vaguely tricksterish way, but that there is stuff that's happening that's, you know, still kind of extraordinary.
Mm-hmm. And especially, I mean, even on the mediums part, again, that if we're talking about this as a rare place where women can exert something that's at least a little like agency or importance, then to what degree, and again, we don't have to think of them as self-deceiving in a complete sense, but what went into there, if they are manufacturing the phenomena, then maybe, I'm trying to figure out a good way to say this, it's not as malicious as they're not doing it and as a malevolent sense that we would normally think of. In other words, they're doing it for some really complex reason that needs to be investigated, that has to do with kind of their own cultural position
So we got about 10 minutes here left, and I know you've written, you mentioned the new article that you have coming out about looking at this set of questions as a kind of anticipation of some of the things people are talking about now in terms of post-humanism.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't you tell us, I mean, you know, post-humanism is one of those terms that means different things to different people. How are you thinking about those issues and questions, and how does this, you know, historical stuff help us understand some of these questions that, you know, people are wrestling with now as we look towards the very peculiar future?
Yeah. Well, the way that I think about post-humanism, I mean, I think the thing that people immediately latch onto when they think of the term is like the android or the cyborg, or maybe people think about virtual communities or the extension of ourselves and our lives online, like Facebook and other kind of social forums. And so that's one way to think about it, and to think about it in a kind of, and so that they're kind of the human coming together with the technological, sometimes in a really even tight bodily sense. Like if we think about the cyborg, the figure of the cyborg as part human, part neurological, or if we think about the android as a technological simulation of the human. So that's one way to think about the post-human. And then I think I also like to think about it in a broader sense, which says that post-human is kind of like post-humanism. In other words, it's a reflection on humanism, this kind of enlightenment idea of the human subject as someone who's autonomous, who's rational, who really is a subject, who is distinct from the environment and kind of has mastery over the environment, and is privileged in terms of, in ontological terms, is privileged over animals and has control and creates the machines in the environment. So what post-humanism does is to take those humanistic ideas of the self as just a self that's reflecting and is kind of is self-willed in the world.
And I always think of post-human, this is a funny word thing I do, but I think post-human and posthumous.
Uh-huh.
So I always think like post-humanism is like a way to try to control death, right?
Yeah.
To try and live posthumously, like to put so much cyborg stuff into your body that you now are able to take control of that nature force, which is like, you know, that we would become mortal. So the post-humanism is trying to live posthumously through all this machinery.
Right. And I think the way to kind of think about that, and also just post-humanism in general, is that it's trying to take apart all of those ideas of the human as, like, again, ontologically distinct and privileged from its environment, trying to say, well, no, the human is, like, embedded in the environment and embedded in, is not kind of, doesn't have a privileged subject position relative to, like, animals and machines, but is continuous with them in some ways, so that a lot of times the post-human looks at similarities between the human and the animal, or similarities between the human and the technological, and that's where you get that other sense of the post-human that I was just talking about in there.
Well, how, How do you think this the gender issue plays out? Like, if in terms of this cluster of automatism, sympathy, transmission that really, you know, surrounds the idea of 19th century idea of the feminine, obviously goes into the 20th century as well. What do you think that legacy tells us about these questions now? These questions about the post-human, about how we think about ourselves and our relationship to technological environments. What is there a sort of newer expression of the same cluster, or is there more of a break? How do you see it?
Well, I don't know specifically in terms of gender, but you know, I've been reading some stuff lately that's been thinking about the idea of, and I don't know if you're familiar with this, of the singularity. Which is this idea that, and I'm going to mess it up because I have a very kind of basic idea of it, but I think it's this idea that we're eventually going to be able to, is it simulate consciousness or simulate human capabilities that we normally associate with cognition, or kind of embed ourselves and our lives and the way we operate our lives and the way we think so much with technology to such an extent that we don't really know what's going to, as far as human capability, we don't really know what can come after that. In other words, there's a horizon that we can't see beyond. And I think the singularity is literally like an event in physics, maybe like a black hole that you can't see beyond, so it becomes a metaphor for this. So, and something I've been reading recently, I think it was John Gray that was talking about this, about that this is kind of the new trend parallel to spiritualism, the way that it takes technology and it uses technology to project a kind of human afterlife and a human longevity, because I think the thing about the singularity is also that we're going to immortalize ourselves.
Well, and this is what I always say that's so dumb, like with the singularity thing. I mean, we've constantly gotten to that point. In terms of synthesizing consciousness, look at the stories of Frankenstein, right, or the golems. We're making men. We're making little versions of ourselves all the time.
Yeah.
People think we're going to hit some limit with that posthumous existence. It's kind of always present through these technologies of shamanism, and I think people are just like maybe thinking someday we'll prove it's real and like unavoidable, but the truth is, I mean, I think we keep doing it in every day of our lives. So
yeah, I mean, I think the Frankenstein analogy is really powerful, because we have, I mean, you're absolutely right. We've been doing this as part of the kind of masculinist bent of science to say we will always overcome. We will always pass the next barrier, what seems to be a present barrier. We always pass that in terms of humanity and what it can achieve.
Yeah.
Well, another thing about the singularity that's really interesting when you think about how one of your points about women in the 19th century in spiritualism is that they were able to gain their power through a way of being powerless, that there's a kind of passivity and automatism that actually enables them to take on these social roles. Is it the singularity and the culture of people who are into the singularity actually has a similar weird polarity? Because on the one hand, these folks are generally like very up on technology. It's like, let's keep pushing it. Let's like pedal to the metal. We're going to like see how far we can go. They make all sorts of assumptions about what human beings are and how they work, da-da-da-da. But the moment of a singularity is a moment of total passivity, where it's basically the human capacity to understand, interact, guide, control, et cetera, basically just hits an asymptote that's so extraordinary that for all intents and purposes, we cannot imagine ourselves, project ourselves, manipulate ourselves beyond that kind of point. So it, once again, it's a kind of technological transcendence which is at the same time very techno-positive, like let's do it, let's create new ways of communicating with the spirits, and at the same time it implies almost necessarily a kind of fundamental passivity.
Well, and look at the main guy who does all the singularity stuff, Ray Kurzweil. He's just trying to make his dad live again. It's all Frankenstein stuff.
I didn't know about that.
Yeah, well, if you watch Transcendent Man, he's trying to, like, be able to cryogenically or, like, recreate his dead father. It's ridiculous.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it is interesting to think about the way that idea of final passivity does seem to, like, oppose this, what you would think would be a very positive thing. And I think that's another parallel with the spiritualist moment in the 19th century is I think there was this idea, okay, great, if we have an afterlife and we're all going to live there and it's this kind of perfect or perfectible realm, I think there was still a deep fear that once you got into that realm, you wouldn't be distinct. You wouldn't be the human as you had been on Earth. You'd rather be this kind of bland, in this bland utopian place. And my understanding of what you just said, Eric, was just that kind of strange creepiness.
Yeah. Right?
Like, what happens once we get there? Is it us anymore operating? Or have we just completely been quashed into something passive and bland?
Excellent. Very great questions. Unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there. But thanks so much, Jill, for being on Expanding Mind.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed it.
All right, folks, from Maja and me, keep your minds open.